Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. When I was writing my book about alternative religion in California, The Visionary State, I stumbled across a problem, which is that I came to believe that there was something very particular about the religious creativity that had gone on in the state since, you know, the mid-19th century. And there were a lot of reasons for this, historical reasons, certainly. You know, it was the end of the frontier. It drew a lot of crazy creative people. They wound up in a place that had no organic cultural traditions, and so they made up a lot of stuff. There's a lot of other historical reasons as well. But I also came to suspect, and this was really a sort of shift for me, that there was something about the place, something about the particular land, its geology, its dynamics, its relationship to sea and sky and mountain and desert, its particular topography that actually sort of helped stage what was happening here. I think this is true all over the world, and it partly explains why certain areas have a lot of religious and spiritual activity clustered around them. And I'm not really talking about ley lines or energy lines exactly, although I think that those stories and experiences point to something really profound about our relationship to the land. But there's another factor in this, this idea that we could sort of dig beneath the cultural layer to get down to some natural ground that would help explain religious or spiritual activity, feelings, intensities, which is that the ground is always complicated, and it's always, as our guest today notes in the title of his book, haunted. And in my situation, it was haunted by the fact that before white people showed up, before the Spanish showed up, it was a land full of indigenous tribes. The Native American landscape of California was extraordinary in its diversity and its density. There were people everywhere, and they spoke an extraordinarily rich range of languages, much more so than in the rest of the continental United States. It was a very, very diverse and rich place, and yet, for a variety of particularly tragic reasons, a lot of these stories have been thoroughly erased. And while there are, of course, many tribes that continue to exist and hold on to their and recreate sometimes their own cultural traditions, that the rupture in California is particularly drastic. And so in relating and describing the spiritual history of the place, it kind of begins with this horrifying Holocaust. And any attempt to try to get to nature, to get to the magical power of California as a geography, as a place on the a physical place on the planet, has to encounter and deal with, to the best it can, the sort of reverberations of this Holocaust. And in some sense, that is part of the fundamental kind of anxiety of American religion, is that in all of its glory and fascination as an expression, as a creative gesture, as an attempt to come up with something new in its inventiveness, is that it happens in the context of this extraordinary expropriation of peoples and landscapes. And so earlier, relationships to the landscape. So this sense of haunted ground, which our guest Daryl Katrine, and I should have checked with your name, fix my pronunciation if such is necessary, talks about in his book about journeys into a paranormal America. What he does in this wonderful book, is to visit three different zones of kind of American fringe religion, which in many ways is American mainstream religion and is certainly the more interesting part of American religion in a lot of ways. And his examples are Lily Dale in New York, a still living center for spiritualism, the huge 19th century religion of using seances to speak with the spirits of the dead. And he goes to a couple of UFO conferences and sort of gets into that zone. And finally, he goes up to Vermont to visit some dowsers. And while people might think of dowsing as a slightly paranormal kind of old country tradition, of course, dowsing comes out of a very rich tradition of hermetic and natural magic. And in all of these cases, he finds himself wrestling with this problem of the haunted ground, the simultaneous desire to get to a real nature beyond culture, beyond even religion as we normally think about it, to get down to the energetics, the physical reality of the cosmos that we live in with, to have that direct relationship. And yet in each case, that connection is haunted by other stories, other pasts, other tragedies, and other people, and particularly Native Americans in the American context. And in a more recent article, which we'll also get to, that really tickled my fancy, he wrote about The Haunted Grid, Nature, Electricity, and Indian Spirits in the American Metaphysical Tradition. And in that, he points to something most peculiar, which is that if you start digging through the lore of spiritualism or looking at the Shakers in the 19th century, you'll find that there's the tradition, which, you know, lives large in today's ayahuasca culture and in the New Age and in neo-shamanism, the tradition of Anglo-Americans and other non-indigenous folk encountering native spirits and receiving wisdom or wrestling with native cosmologies goes way back to the beginnings of the Republic. But he discovered something else, or rather elaborates something other people have talked about, but that I didn't really know about, is that in a lot of these accounts, particularly in the 19th century, the spirits of Native Americans are mixed up with, of all things, technology, ideas about technology, about electromagnetic devices, spiritual telegraphs, occult radios, and other sorts of devices. So this is a very interesting connection to me, how these different kinds of spirits link together. So we have a lot to talk about today. But before we bring Daryl onto the show, we have our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, how are things hanging with you there down in Los Angeles?
It's a lovely sunny day here in LA.
And what's been going on with you? What have you been dreaming lately?
Oh, the usual tomfoolery is going on in Dreamtown. I had crazy dreams the last couple nights, I feel like. It was a lot of, like, Three's Company-style dreams where I was trying to navigate a misunderstanding that wasn't even real. So I had, like, two dreams the last couple nights where there was some big, like, melodrama, and I was able to kind of, like, pop out of the melodrama and see, oh, my God, this is all stupid.
If only we could bring that easily into our normal lives.
Right, really. You know, I wanted to say what you were saying earlier. It reminded me a lot of the conversation we had with Alan Moore when he was on the show, and he was talking about, like, the blood of the people in the land, when he was talking about where he was from in England and how his ancestors and their blood intermixes with the land you're on. And I always think about this with America. If you think about, if the earth is like one thing, like think about if it's like you with your memory of all kinds of everything that's ever happened to you, it's almost like the earth is like you with all its memories on all its parts. So it's like if it stubbed its toe, which let's say is Africa, there'll be like some kind of imprint of that. And I always think of America, if you think about, the earth makes different kinds of people in different places. That's just true. Different parts of the earth make different kinds of people. They'll look a little different. They'll have these different nuances. But if you think about America, America's like if all the little parts of people, which are just parts of the earth, because we're kind of like made from the earth and other stuff, depending on what you think. And then if all these pebbles from all these other parts of the earth all came and like accumulated on America, it has, America has its own indigenous thing. And then there's the spirits in the land, which is like all the fairy stuff. And then there's the natives that lived on the land for a super long time. And then there's all these other like pebbly people that come from all over. So it's such an interesting, like a
mosaic.
Yeah, totally. It's a total.
No, but it's a good,
like,
people say mosaic, you know, like they just throw, oh, they're mosaic, you know, sort of an older idea, an older kind of multicultural idea than the ones we're, right, and sort of a charming one because it is this idea,
yeah,
you can take fragments and bits and little chunks of rock and put them together and something really cool comes,
yeah,
out. So
true.
I'm still holding on to the mosaic vision, and I suspect our guest is as well. Anyway, Daryl, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you, Eric. It's great to be on the show.
And now, to pronounce your last name.
You did a great job. It's Catherine. Yes.
Excellent. Daryl Catherine, and I neglected to mention that you are a professor of religion at the at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, right?
That's right. Yes. Yes.
And you're from the Northeast.
I am. I grew up in northern New England, in New Hampshire, and I loved all the things you were saying in the beginning, talking about my book and articles and such. I guess you could say I grew up in what Grail Marcus once called the old weird America, at least on my mom's side, which I would describe as a veneer of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant sensibility haunted by something that's never talked about. It's kind of Stephen King's America, too. So,
well, how did you I would like to talk more about that because I'm really fascinated by that mixture. I mean, was it a kind of Scots-Irish style? Was it even more polyglot? Was it the sort of mixture of all sorts of different peoples and lore that sort of had this, you know, Anglo-Protestant veneer? What was that old weird America that you carry to some degree?
Right. Well, in my own case, my father's side is Italian, so it's even stranger. It's a Catholic Protestant sort of thing. On my mom's side, though, that family has been here since the 1600s. There's a lot of Scottish, actually, that runs through family line. But growing up, actually not so much growing up in New England, but I moved away to California to do graduate school work, and I came back and taught in New Hampshire for a while. And as an adult, as an older person, it just struck me as very strange that there was this culture built in New England, very especially in the North, very very WASP, very Protestant, very stayed, and there was absolutely no acknowledgement anywhere of, as you were saying before, what was here before. And I write about this in the section of my book where I'm talking about dowsing, because I come back to this, but what really kind of flipped the switch for me in terms of this haunted ground stuff was encountering these anomalous stone structures in the land of northern New England, things like cairns and standing stone circles and such that have been there for hundreds of years. Nobody knows where they came, who built them. And it was just a very vivid and physicalized reminder that there was a lot of other things going on in that place that were not acknowledged by the culture that's there. I mean, I'd grown up there. I'd never heard of these things, so it was just doubly strange. And as I say, that sort of was the catalyst, I think, to really kind of go down into this other layer that's in the mix here of what was before.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I that was one of the more striking things in your book that something I didn't know anything about were some of these structures. There's one you describe where it's sort of they're like they could they sort of they're sort of cellar like kind of partly under the ground, but they have very, very large stones that are constructing them. And some people said, oh, these are just sort of root cellars. But then it seems like from the record that all the root cellars that the colonists made were made with wood, or, and so that the idea that they would use huge stones seems kind of weird. So there is this sort of sense of the unknown coursing beneath the surface in America. And of course that also becomes, as you talk about very well in your book, part of the whole lore of Mormonism, which we think of again as like a straight religion. It's the, you know, they run the FBI, they're very clean cut, and they make money really well. But they're actually, if you go back historically, Joseph Smith comes from a very weird situation that is completely bound up with these more hidden hermetic traditions, as well as this fascination and kind of fantastic, almost comic book imagination about the Native Americans and what happened with them and why they were here and what their world was about, what their civilization was about. So there's no way of extricating these things, it seems like, from the American religious imagination.
No, not at all. And Mormonism is such a great place to start thinking about this stuff, because as you were saying earlier, what gets sort of brushed aside sometimes as American fringe religion turns out to be really close to the heart of the real stuff that was going on here: Native American displacement, violence, European disorientation. And Joseph Smith's story is just pretty interesting from a number of different perspectives. The angel, so-called, the angel Moroni, who appears to Joseph Smith, according to legend, is, if you actually think about it, a Native American ghost, because Moroni is a transformed Native American who in a sense is a, in the hermetic world of Joseph Smith, you can almost think of Moroni as being a spirit familiar who guides Joseph Smith to write the Book of Mormon and so forth. But so here you have in the heart of the, as you said, this what's perceived as a straight-laced religion, this really a Native American ghost slash familiar spirit dictating a revelation about America and so forth. So it's people don't usually pair up the paranormal with Mormonism, but and that's not my idea either. I drew heavily from the work of D. Michael Quinn, who's a former LDS historian. But if you follow that trail, you'll find some really interesting things.
So I'm curious, when you decided to write your book and you picked these three zones, the spiritualism enclave in New York, the UFO scene out west, and the dowsing folks, what was it that drew you? Because, you know, you're it's not a normal academic book. You're not just laying out tons of theory in a kind of dry way. It's a very personal story. You describe your encounters, your confusions, the look and feel of the place. I mean, you're really on a journey. You're on a search, and part of it is to just find out what's going on with these scenes. But there's something more going on there. So I'm kind of curious, like, how you sort of launched into the project, which is really this sort of ongoing, you know, journey of discovery.
Absolutely. Two parts to that answer, I suppose. The first part is, in my field of American religion, there's a lot of great stuff on individual movements within the and here I pause. I've never found a good word, a good category, the paranormal, the metaphysical, what have you. So in other words, there are great studies on spiritualism, there's stuff on mesmerism, etc. But what I wanted to do was to get a sort of bird's eye view of a longer continuous tradition that seemed to morph in shape and form over time and manifest sometimes as spiritualism, sometimes as ufology, et cetera, et cetera. So in some sense, my choice was dictated by the logistics of ethnography. So my original idea was to do something on chasing crop circles, and as a colleague pointed out to me, they'd probably be gone before I got there. So I had to think about places that had some stability, that were open and public, where I could visit easily. And so the three that I write about in my book, as you said, Lilydale, which is a community of mediums here in upstate New York, the Roswell UFO Festival, and the American Society of Dowsers Conference in Vermont, those were just three of the places where that I visited and spent the most time, I should say. I also dipped into West Virginia to where the Mothman allegedly was seen back in the 60s, and Edgar Casey's homeland in Kentucky, and a lot of other places as well. So I was looking at first for, I wanted to find deeper patterns or deeper connections, a general picture that I couldn't find in the literature. And then the second part of the answer, as you say, the book was, it was very difficult to write the book in any other way besides an ongoing narrative, because what I didn't want to do and what I don't want to do is to kind of give a ready-made explanation or academic argument about what's really going on with these things. So I spent a year or two, I would write these drafts of the book, and they just feel, they didn't capture the feeling tone of these places. The academic prose was too rigid, it was too formal. And I was really trying or hoping to capture, indeed, a kind of weirdness to these movements and to this phenomena, the ineffability. And so when I started writing as a narrator as opposed to an academic professional, then it started to flow. The prose started to happen. And on a deeper conceptual level, I also began to realize that my work as an academic, as an ethnographer, is really not so different than what dowsers are doing or what spiritualists are doing. I'm in the profession of giving an illusory solidity to a world that is really quite ephemeral and shifting, and indeed, I think, quite unknowable in certain areas. So not only was I narrating, but as you said, I was at points trying to be really transparent about my own uncertainty and my own surprise. So that's how it came out, and that's what's in print now. So,
yeah. The thing about that really intrigues me is just that notion of like how to write as a journalist or as a scholar who's you know moving through texts and using concepts to explain, to clarify, and at the same time at the heart of it to keep the uncertainty alive and productive.
Yes.
And that's a really interesting you know challenge because you gotta it's like this knife edge between you know you can't there's no way out you know you can't if you just you can't decide the phenomenon's real and go over to the other side and then you write as if it's real because it doesn't look like that's exactly what's going on and yet
yeah.
to fall on a side of explanation or the kind of illusion of knowing exactly what's going on is also sort of an error. So it's quite an interesting alchemy to try to pull off, and as you said it's appropriate to the material at hand. And so one question is, what do you think you learned by physically going to these places and interacting with, you know, the sort of random group of people who runs into when you visit sites, as opposed to just reading and going online or reading books? What did you learn that sort of shifted your sense of what your overall topic was?
Right. Well, I'd like to elaborate on the great things you were saying in the beginning of the show about the, what should you say, the spirits of place, Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenetic field. I couldn't use that term, but a by going to places. I do believe, as Maja was saying a few minutes ago, there's a. I'm very persuaded by the the Native American idea that not only does the land have a presence and an influence on the people who live in a place, but also what the people do in that place affect the spirit of the site. So there's a kind of two-way back and forth thing going on, and the overarching theme, sadly, it didn't matter where I was within the borders of the continental United States. The not only was it a feeling, it was writ large in the symbolism of these places. It was like the aftershock or the reverberation of violence and death, which is the very real underside, right, of not only American history but colonial history. But I think particularly in the North American part of the world, United States and Canada, I mean, we're really talking about, you know, we paved over the place and called it nature and sort of went from there. And I'm laughing, probably I shouldn't be laughing, but sort of gallows humor. But so in other words, what I felt and what I saw and what I heard people talk about in these veiled ways, that was what was interesting about it to me. So in other words, dowsers don't talk about the, you know, the violence of the Native Americans, or ufologists don't talk about that. But instead you have, for example, you know, what's going on with these experiences that people have of being abducted by alien others. These narratives, for just to take this as one example, these narratives bear striking resemblance to the early captivity narratives that the English colonists were writing in the colonial context of being kidnapped and tortured by Indians and coming back transformed. Spiritualism is a really, really good example. Not so much today, although it does continue, but in the 19th century, as you were saying about the ayahuasca folks, et cetera, everyone has this Indian spirit guide, and they're clearly caricatured. They're clearly of the time. So it's, again, to go back to my my old weird American upbringing, once again, I found myself amidst people who were talking about something that they couldn't quite name, but they were kind of getting close. So it was about innuendo or illusion or stuff like this. And part of my job was to try to lift that out and make it a little bit clearer.
No, I think that's really well said. And one of the I think it's worth mentioning where that phrase "old weird America" comes from, where Grail Marcus is talking about a sort of a tradition, a way of appreciating American folk music, not folk music in the side of in the sort of like, you know, clean, happy sense, but really the fact that if you dig through these recordings, you find stuff that's really kind of peculiar, that seems sort of unpleasant, maybe even ghoulish, maybe confusing, maybe even a bit crazy. And he was referring to a collection that that Harry Smith had put together in the 1950s that proved to be incredibly influential on the folk boom. But the point was that a lot of the record, you know, Harry Smith was a record collector. He had huge numbers of 78s, black music, hillbilly music. But the records that he selected to put together were all the ones that had exactly what you were talking about, this sort of uncanny sense that's proximate to death or unpleasant activities, that they're haunted, there's something peculiar going on, and they're also funny and joyous as well. It's not like it's a strictly dark thing, but there's something about that uncanny quality of haunting that really points to historical reality almost better than telling the story. Once again, we could sit here and go through, you know, a kind of horror list of the major battles and how the Native Americans died and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you could get all this, right, and you sort of recognize, oh, yes, history is a horrifying thing. And yet sometimes those stories enable us not to actually feel like what it is like to live in live on haunted ground, which is what we all do. Sometimes you have to sneak up on it. And it seems like the people that you're writing about, not always that they're aware that they're doing this, but that's part of what's motivating this search, is not just to get a new age answer or to have a fantasy, you know, compensate for the tedium of ordinary life, but they're actually trying to work out some major contradictions that are in our psyches and in our dreams, as well as in the facts on the ground.
That's so well said. I have a bunch of things flying through my mind. One of them is Jeffrey Kripal's this idea that when you get into the paranormal, you're not only writing, but you're being written by something. And in this case, as you said, you use the word feeling. It's not just about recounting the laundry list of tragedies, but it's about living in the aftermath of that and how that is shaping you in ways that perhaps you're not even aware of. Avery Gordon in Ghostly Matters talks about the seething presence of absence, and she's talking about African-American, the unnamed African-American dead in Southern literature and so forth. And another thing that's flying through my mind here is, and this actually is relevant to my work, because before I got interested in the paranormal, my interests in graduate school had to do with Latin American and Latino religions, which are all about an acknowledged encounter between cultures, right? So you're dealing with mixture and syncretism and borderlands and all that great stuff. And then you get up into Anglo-North America, and all of that reality of whether the encounter was violent or whether the encounter was life enhancing, it's just not talked about in the culture. So there's a sort of borderlands thing going on here too for me that's by way of contrast. So this is a sort of haunted borderlands, if you will.
We got to take a break here in just a second, but I just want to underscore that, because that's something that took me a long time to understand and to differentiate in the new world, is this really significant difference between what happens south of the border in terms of mixtures, that even though there's, you know, tremendous violence and you know, tragedy in Central America, in South America, that what we see today is there's a great deal of acknowledgement of all of these degrees of mixture, of mestizos, culture as being separate from indigenous culture, but still separate from urban culture. But the urban cultures themselves are drawing from these mestizo and indigenous cultures. And there's this great mixture of syncretism, and, you know, the Catholic saints represent the African deities, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody knows this. Everybody. The conservatives know it. The liberals know it. The indigenous know it. And yet, and then you cross north of the border, and there's just it's a whole different scene, where it's really complicated to acknowledge and recognize even all the similar kinds of mixtures that are going on here, partly because of the difference with Protestantism. There's a lot of reasons, but it really makes a big difference. So I'm glad you pointed that out.
Cool.
But we do have to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Daryl Katterine, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Daryl Katterine about haunted ground. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what you mentioned with that pervasive feeling that you felt everywhere of the memory of the violence in the land, because this is something I think about a lot. And I was wondering if you could maybe, if you had any personal experiences of this in your, especially in your religious research, how there's this idea that something happens when blood through violence mixes with the earth, right? That's a very big story through a lot of traditions. It's obviously at the root of that concept of what evil is, like in terms of Cain and Abel, and how in a lot of traditions, when they talk about these kind of murder things, how something happens when that occurs. So I was wondering if you saw or experienced any kind of like feeling about that, the role of the blood and how it intermixes with the land to kind of make that relationship. Or that's almost like a very abstract thing, but it seems to be like that is this thing that makes that memory occur, is when this violent blood and the earth mix, it like kind of creates that result. I don't know how to kind of say it.
Yeah, very powerful stuff. I guess part of the answer would go back, as I was talking initially about just growing up in New England, and I guess I'd have to think a little bit about the blood in particular, but this feeling of, as Eric was saying before, it's not overwhelmingly horrible or anything, but
right.
There's a like a lingering. Something's wrong. Something's off. It's hard to feel peaceful in some places. I mentioned Stephen King before. I actually really think that Stephen King, being from Maine, being from Northern New England, taps into that energetic trace. So, that's one thing I would say. The other thing is, it's a sort of a non sequitur, but it's very, very much related, is I'm finally living in a part of the world here in upstate New York where there's still a very viable and visible Native presence. And the local Onondaga Nation here outside of Syracuse is starting a new cultural center called the Skunnon Center, and Skunnon is an Onondaga word for good mind, sort of whole mind. And I think their vision is to it's really as much of an act of healing, healing the place, as it is a kind of, you know, cultural event, although it's that as well. So I think you didn't ask me about this, but sort of where my mind is going is that there's a way in which there has to be some sort of acknowledgement and some kind of healing work that has to happen before we can live here all comfortably and peacefully and really.
I know, it's like it needs an exorcism or something, right? I mean, I know it's
yeah.
Like if you study paranormal, and like with my experiences too, with any kind of ghost stuff, and with all the, like, Chinese stuff, I've researched it, and certainly Native, it's mostly, like, if there's something that went wrong in that kind of way, they say it, like, makes this animal spirit that attaches, right? In Chinese, they call it your po, or, like, your that kind of soul or spirit that lingers through murder, and it needs acknowledgement. It needs to get that, like, you have to turn it from a hungry ghost into this...
Yes.
Thing that gets like, hey, I see you there. We messed you all up. I'm sorry. And sometimes it feels like if that doesn't happen, it just remains butthurt. Like there's just all this butthurt kind of lingering that just has to get like an apology almost or something.
We're in agreement. It's funny you should say hungry ghost too, because that's how I think about it actually a lot. Is that, you know, sometimes the energy is malevolent and sometimes it's just that. You know, maybe it's reflected in this awful American thing of we have so much abundance and yet everyone's sort of starving to death, you know.
Yeah.
So figuratively as well, unfortunately, as literally, but, you know, there's an addictive kind of disease that afflicts the culture so many times. And I think that resonates with that idea of the hungry ghost not being propitiated. I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that politically in terms of this, the idea of, it's been really stuck in my head about the idea of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, you know, which have this very powerful expression in, you know, a number of different places, but particularly in South Africa. And
yeah.
what I've been thinking about is not the reparation side of it, not even the bringing blame in a kind of, you know, in the sense of a judicial process where blame is apportioned and, you know, and direct literal responsibility is taken, so much as a site, a place, a performance where historical and these the enormity of history gets voice in the present. And yeah, looking yeah. at all this, you know, all the incredibly difficult things that are happening with race in America that have always been happening, but have, you know, come to public consciousness in the last, you know, few months through these tragedies and through the reactions to them and all of this sort of stuff that's been stirred up by it. And I sometimes think it's like, and I don't know what it would look like. I don't know if it's possible, but it's I'm not thinking here about reparations or the proper way to literalize the problem. It's almost the opposite as to how to acknowledge the metaphors, the ghosts, the intangible psychic residue of the horrors of slavery, of the horrors of the you know, indigenous Holocaust, if you want to think about it that way. And any number of other historical events, not to, again, apportion blame. Oh, the white people, it's all your fault, privilege, da, da, da. But there's some other kind of acknowledgement, some other kind of recognition. And I do think that that is a lot what's going on with actual ghosts and hauntings, that a lot of that stuff really is some kind of echo in the mind, in the place, in history of these tragic events that just by their very nature, historical trauma is not. It doesn't just disappear. You know, those traumatic waves, they echo, they reverberate, they're in our minds, they're in our behaviors. And so sort of bringing some of that more open, more uncertain, more sensitive kind of mind, the mind that you bring to these paranormal groups or that people who are thinking, people who are also into these things, who are, you know, themselves trying to navigate through the spectral aspects of the world, that it is partly tuning in and acknowledging and to some degree perhaps healing in relationship to these huge historical traumas rather than pretending we can just ignore them or move on or even just apportion blame as if that's going to be the answer. So it's a difficult work, but it seems like something that people are aware of. I mean, this cultural center you're talking about, it's there partly to not just do what they want to do, but to respond to this historical situation, which is of course so, you know, overwhelming.
Absolutely. You use the word trauma so many times, and I think that there is a traumatic dimension to our country, others as well. But and one of the things too is that we're all bound up in it together. So in other words, you know, I'm not trying to do that sort of thing where it's, you know, white people hurt too kind of thing. But I mean, but there is a sense in which we've all gotten hit by the shrapnel in some way, and I think the dominant culture sometimes has a difficulty in admitting its vulnerability, in admitting its weakness, in admitting its woundedness. You know, I think of Jimmy Carter's Malaise speech, you know, and he got run out of town for saying, you know, Americans are depressed, you know. But I think, so again, there's the ethnic consideration here that all of these movements that I'm looking at are coming predominantly out of a European American culture, which is really interesting to me. It's that culture is trying to work out something in relation to this trauma too. So,
Yeah, it's really accurate. And the idea of traumas that are on cultural levels, right? Like, think about how each individual deals personally with their own trauma. If we just, like, take a smattering, like, Jimmy Carter sure was correct, right? If you look at how do Americans deal with their trauma, like, look at what are the options that currently most people choose, correct? They choose to mostly get drunk. I think you could probably say that, although I'm not sure about the statistics. That's probably, like, the A number one. And then there's a lot of medication that occurs. Obviously, there's people who also confront and deal with and kind of process through those things. But if we as individuals, like, can't even handle trauma, then when we get these, like, macro traumas, And then there's, like, you know, all this stuff piled on top of it. If we have zero ways to kind of address it, I think everyone just kind of wants to get drunk or something. Like,
yeah, or strike back, or we get angry and we strike back. And, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was thinking, too, actually, when we were all talking, it's just such a classic trope, if you will, right, that if you go back to the Middle Ages, ghosts came to tell the living that something unjust had happened. That was one of the common things. So here's this almost a collective ghost story of the past coming back and saying, "Hey, you know, I'm not going to leave you alone here. We're not going to go away until you deal with us." You know, yeah.
I want to throw in another dimension here that that I brought up before, which is this question about how technology plays into, at least in the 19th century, this other zone that we're talking about. I mean, normally we think of these as being entirely different zones. You know, technology is that's what, you know, the Anglo-American civilization creates, and that's how it's mastering the world. That it would be the opposite, that it would be the last place where you would see any kind of connection between that and these ghosts of a pre-modern world that are still holding on in some kind of way in that kind of historical frame. So what were some of these connections that you found looking at the historical roots of these hauntings in the 19th century?
That is a great question, and it's one that I've been thinking about ever since I wrote the book. There is a kind of recurring threefold pattern that I keep seeing here, which is, you know, the nature, primitive, native ghosts, and machines. And that can be thought about in a number of different ways. First, I guess, you know, it was through technology and through science that America and other modern Europeans sort of claimed their superiority over the non-European others. It was through technology that that the dominant cultures subjugated the others. And there's also, this is not so much in my book, but this is something that I've been thinking about more recently. If you look at and this is actually, Eric, can I say here on the air, I'm a great fan of your work and your book Technosis. I use that often in my classrooms. But there's this idea also, I think, in which, as Bruno Latour says, we have really never been modern, and that even as science is sort of and technology are breaking onto the scene, they're being performed as a new kind of magic. So there's a real weird ambiguity about science and technology as well. So there are all sorts of sort of strange and interesting things going on here in the mix.
And the when you were looking at particularly at the UFO stuff, where there's obviously more connections with technology, at least on the surface, you know, these are advanced technologies that are bringing them here. If the part of the UFO phenomenon is the result of you know, disinformation campaigns, media manipulation, even mind control technologies is often part of the lore that one comes across. Mm-hmm. Did you find that the what was the relationship between ideas about technology or ideas about the future on the one hand, and on the other, this sort of carryover of an older tradition of abduction scenarios or the haunted after echoes of an earlier American history? Like, how did technology and this kind of tradition of haunted nature cross in the UFO culture that you were investigating?
Right. Well, in two ways. First, there's a kind of mythology going on of the primitive scientist or the ancient scientific culture that sort of was lost and that is now, through our own cultural efforts, being rediscovered. And as part of that, this is not so much ufology. My mind's going in a couple of different ways, but let me just say more generally that throughout a lot of these metaphysical paranormal movements, the medium or the dowser or even the mesmerist is thinking about him or herself as being a kind of hybrid, primitive modern magician. There's a kind of very liminal kind of identity of a mesmerist or a medium or of a dowser as a sort of return of the primitive, but with new and improved technology. I can clarify that if you need. So.
Yeah, no, that's a good connection. What sounds like you're talking about is that a lot of what we see in contemporary, let's call it, you know, I don't know, again, what do you call it, metaphysical, new age, paranormal, let's say paranormal, that okay. There's this sense that there's a return to a pre-modern worldview where yeah. There's access to energy, there's access to different dimensions of reality, there are access to different incorporeal beings, to the power of the elements, towards intuition, to dream, all of that. And mm-hmm. yet there's a difference, there's a twist, there's a shift where there's somehow the aspects of the rational tradition of technology, of science, of systems, of certain ways of interpreting scientific reality kind of have changed that. So there's a new sort of mixture going on, a new kind of hybrid. Is that sort of what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's almost as if to say, I'm thinking about, okay, so let's look at mesmerism, for example. And James Esdale was a British doctor who practiced mesmerism in colonial India, and he used mesmerism to anesthetize Indian patients. You know, he would present what he was doing as a kind of a Western form of Hindu magic. You know, almost like a new and improved version. Or also from the mesmeric tradition, James Braid, who actually invented the term hypnotism, wrote a whole history of hypnosis in which things like yogic techniques and so forth, shamanic techniques from other cultures, were written about as the sort of prelude or the background to what finally culminated as hypnotism. And this is where it gets really weird. So he's presenting hypnotism as a kind of science, but he's also working out what hypnotism is in a dialogue with what the West itself is calling magic, right? So there's this really weird, we're kind of like, but we're kind of different from what you all primitive, quote-unquote, people are doing. That's an example of that.
No,
I mean, would you compare that to being similar to the appropriation of land? I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Check it out, right? These white people come over, they just take the land and leave all this trauma, murder everyone, and then we kind of, like, appropriate all the things from other cultures where we take them over, which India, of course, like the white people took over in the form of Britain, and then we take their stuff and we say that it's our stuff and we just did it better than you guys did.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and let us tell you what was actually going on.
Sorry.
That you didn't quite understand. You were doing a pretty good job, but let us clarify now.
Wow.
From the perspective of modern science and rationality. Yeah,
yeah.
It's completely.
Well, it's also this discussion really points out to me, it really underlines one of my big themes is the importance of looking at history when you approach these matters, when you look at questions of the paranormal or even just psychology in general. And the example of hypnotism is great because if you just say, well, look, there wasn't always hypnotism, whatever that word means exactly. It evolves and it comes about through a very, you know, a process that you can chart through history. And in so doing, you start to understand that there are these fundamental ambiguities that keep getting kind of it's like a hot potato. You pass it on. It's like, well, we can keep this part of the phenomenon and we can incorporate it into science. And we can incorporate it as hypnotism, even though hypnotism is pretty weird. And
it's
in the 19th
weird.
Century, when they started to explore what we now call hypnotism, they would discover effects that we would recognize now as hypnotic effects. But they would also discover a lot of effects that seemed like, well, the paranormal, that seemed like clairvoyance, that seemed like clairaudience. And at the time, it was one phenomenon. And it's only at a certain point when, for a variety of reasons, institutions, knowledge production, authorities, they go, hey, we're going to keep this part because we have to, because there's clearly a real phenomenon here. But we're going to leave this other stuff aside. We're not going to talk about that clairvoyant stuff anymore. And then, and it's only then that the clairvoyance becomes the occult, becomes supernatural. Before that, it's actually really mixed up in a way that people don't really understand what to do with. And there's different accounts and people are arguing. So even these categories that we used, the paranormal, the occult, the metaphysical, are themselves trying to wrestle with this weirdness that we can't contain and keeps coming back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we really have no idea what mind is, right? We really don't know what matter is either, but that's a whole other thing. But we certainly don't know what mind is, right? So in a way, we're sort of, well, like Latour says, we've really never been modern. We're still just sort of spinning our wheels in the face of this mystery, but renaming it and reappropriating it. And I think also, just want to throw in, I think that this this historical, as you're saying, this historical association that the paranormal has with the so-called primitive, eventually gets used against it, right, by mainstream science, which doesn't want to touch it, for reasons I think that are as much cultural as they are scientific. You know, they don't want to get
on that. No, we're going to have to leave it. Daryl, Katarine, thank you so much for speaking this on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you so much to both of you. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Daryl's book, Haunted Ground. For me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.